Okay, so the last session of the day is normally the Office for Disability, but this time we thought it would be timely to have an information session on the Information Linkages and Capacity Building Program. And let's face it, that's why you're all here, right? Yeah. So given that a lot of organisations are in attendance today have been affected by the funding changes in the sector and are looking into the ILC program to meet the needs of your clients, I'm sure you will welcome everything you learned from today. So you probably remember Daniel Layton from Inclusion Melbourne, and he's now sorting all your ILC problems out. Is that correct?
You try,
okay. So welcome, Daniel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Sorry for the delay in setting up the screen. My name is Daniel Layton. I'm the branch manager of ILC, or Information Linkages and Capacity Building. And it's a pleasure to be here with you to talk about ILC and its directions. Let me begin, particularly during NAIDOC week, by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay my deep and personal respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. So I wanted us to have the chance to have a conversation and basically just run through ILC, where we've been, where we're heading, and have the chance to engage with you. So whilst I'm standing here in front of the microphone to support those people who need that, I'm quite happy, given we're not such a big group, to take questions throughout. So as I'm sure all of you will know, the goal of ILC is ultimately to create a more accessible and inclusive and connected Australia. And ILC is taking over the provision of services that have traditionally been part of state and territory funding in relation to provision of information around disability, as well as supporting a wide range of services around that have supported people with a disability. The NDIA began implementing the ILC policy, which was agreed to by COAG in 2015. And since that time, there has been a range of grant rounds that have been run and a series of documents that have been put out. And I don't really need to walk through each of those, just to say that there has been a fair bit of work that's gone on to get us to the point where we are now. So in delivering all of those grant rounds, there were a few lessons that were learned and consideration given as to what actually would be the best way to roll out ILC, and more importantly, what is the best way to support the organisations who do this very vital work. And in developing the strategy, the team looked at what were some of the lessons from those grant rounds. And the first one that stands out, as I'm sure you're all aware, annual grants. That grants that are only of 12-month duration are cumbersome for you. They're also cumbersome for my team. And they take up time, and they also don't provide the certainty that's required in order to ensure the viability of the organisation. They also don't necessarily provide enough time to actually make a sustainable and impactful change. And that's what we really want to do. We've also seen a whole lot of projects and activities that have been a bit of a scattergun approach, and we wanted to have a bit more of a national focus where we could measure outcomes and we could look at measuring those outcomes and then look at how we could quickly replicate or scale those activities to rapidly support people with a disability across the country. And we also learnt the difficulty that many organisations have around their own organisational capacity, and we began to think about what we could do to support people and smaller organisations, particularly disabled persons organisations, to be able to be better prepared and more resilient so that they can spend more time in their communities doing the good work that they've been doing. And taking all of that into consideration, the policy that's up on the screen now was released in December last year. And in it, it created four programs: an individual capacity building program, a national information program, a mainstream community building program, and an economic and community participation program. The strategy released finally a clear purpose, which was about investing to create more inclusive services, communities, and workplaces, and also set up some clear outcomes. With the ultimate outcome is that people with a disability are actively contributing to leading, shaping, and influencing their community. The four programs, as I mentioned, and I'll run through them in greater detail in a minute, whilst they're seen as discrete, they are also complementary, and we'll explore that throughout the rest of this afternoon. Also sitting within ILC is a fifth program, which is local area coordination, which kind of sits off to the side of the work that I do, which is the delivery of the partners in community around supporting people with a disability in community. So to just look at the summary of activities that are provided through each of the programs, the first program is individual capacity building, which is around enabling systemic access to peer support, mentoring, and other skill building for people with a disability, their families and carers, which will be largely delivered through building and strengthening a national network of disabled persons and family organisations. The National Information Program is around building a core of high quality information that provides information around different disability types and support options in a variety of formats, and looking to disseminate these through the DPFO network and also through partners in the community. The third program is around mainstream capacity building, which is going to focus in on targeting critical mainstream interface areas. And I said that without saying interfaith, as I often do. And to look at how we can get better responses in those areas such as health, education, justice, and housing. And try and bring all of the players together to look at how we can make durable change. And finally, economic and community participation, which, as the name suggests, is around looking at strategies that support employers to employ more people with disability, around building the skills of individuals with disabilities to gain employment, but also a focus in at the micro level within communities at clubs and associations to ensure that they're more accessible and inclusive for people with a disability to be able to participate, not only as members, but as potentially players or as serving on committees. So is that all making sense as an overview? Before I go on, I'm seeing a couple of no's. We'll head into the detail. I'll see if that answers some questions. So firstly, individual capacity building. And this will be the largest of the four programs that will be released. So we're looking at how we provide access to peer support, mentoring, and skill building for people with disability. And we're doing it to establish a systemic approach. We're looking at how we support a national network of disabled persons organisations and families organisations. And where there are gaps, we will look at using other organisations to be able to provide some of these activities. So an underlying approach is that we want to have, after 3 years, a stronger and more resilient, what we're calling DPFO sector. And I appreciate that it's DPOs or DSOs and family organisations, but as in government, we like to just throw everything into something that's easy for people to say. So individual capacity building, what's it about? We're looking at peer-to-peer support, whether that's at the most micro level of people just being able to come together and talk and share information either online or in their local communities. We're looking at, and we'll be calling for activities that support capacity building around building empowerment for individuals. We're looking for ideas and proposals around leadership and professional development for people with a disability. We'd be interested in hearing about programs and activities that support people to be able to, who are participants in the scheme, to be able to self-manage their own plans, but also more generally about how one can build autonomy and active citizenship within community. So that's the sort of thing that, that we are looking to achieve through that individual capacity building program. And there's a couple of extra little bits that I'll talk about later that also support this activity. National information is pretty much as it as it's the name suggests, is around how we gain some consistency and quality in the information that is provided to Australians. And we want to look at information that sits alongside the information that's already provided by government. Now, what we're looking at is, in the first round that's already gone out and is currently under assessment, we requested information by disability type. However, in future rounds, we'll be looking at thematic approaches to provision of information for people with disability, such as how people with a disability might be able to gain access to arts, sport and recreation within their communities, looking at connection to education, other areas of life. So why are we taking this approach? Well, as I mentioned, part of our responsibility is around the provision of information that had previously been the responsibility of state and territory governments. As their contribution to the sector winds up and their funding goes into the NDIS, then it is our responsibility at the Commonwealth level to ensure that these services exist. But we understand first and foremost that the nature of my autism, the nature of my Down syndrome, the nature of my deafness or blindness doesn't change regardless of which side of a state border I am on. So we don't need, for example, 7 or 8 websites around Down syndrome. We don't need 7 or 8 websites about autism. We need one that provides high quality information in each of these areas to provide that information for those cohorts. And there'll be a fair bit of work to do as we seek to build this consistency. Over time, and as flagged within the grant opportunity guidelines, we will be looking to work with the people who receive funding through the National Information Program on the development of a national platform where we can have all of the information available. You know, if you can picture disability.gov type approach. And we'll be using data garnered from the website to look at visitor flows to be able to work out what sorts of information are most relevant to people at different points in their life and journey. So, for example, if we identify that one of the most popular pages on information about Down syndrome is about supporting a young child with Down syndrome to enter into school, and we recognise that we don't have that sort of information for someone who has autism, then we will work with the providers who are delivering that information to develop up equivalent information that provides useful information and tips to support a family and a child with autism to benefit from mainstream education. So that's the approach that we'll be taking, and then obviously we are also going to be undertaking more work around what some of the newer technologies are that can support a person with a disability. So what's the feasibility of using geolocated material through your smartphone so that as a person with a disability is wandering down their street, they might be alerted through message, through a notification to say there is an activity that's been funded here through a DPO that may be of interest to you. They're the sorts of things that we're just trying to get a handle on that might be of interest to people with disabilities, their families and carers, and that we want to see roll out over the next 3 to 5 years. The third program is around mainstream capacity building, and this program's really about driving practice change in the delivery of mainstream services through the development and trialling of what we're terming best practice frameworks. But to explain that, what we're really looking at, because it's not within our province to be able to fund ongoing supports in this space, what we're interested in doing is providing catalytic investments to trial new ideas. So the initial mainstream capacity building program will focus in on health when that is announced. And so we'd be interested in hearing from a hospital about how they might have ideas on how they can improve emergency access presentation by people with a disability. We're interested in proposals around how to improve preventative screening for people with a disability. And I note that both breast screen and prostate screening occur via your name being on the electoral roll. And the majority of people with an intellectual disability aren't on the electoral roll. Therefore, how are they gaining access to these preventative screening measures? So we'd be interested in someone doing work around that. So these projects we're talking about being funded for 18 months to 2 years, potentially up to about $2 million, where we'd like to see, you know, area mental health services partnering with universities, partnering with local organisations with people with a disability to look at how they might trial something new, whether it's about additional training for staff, whether it's about trialling new rostering methods, whether it's about trialling access to interpreters, whether it's about thinking about how they might recut existing data in order to support access for people with a disability. These are the sorts of things we're interested in. Yes? Of course. Absolutely. I prefer to have a conversation rather than a lecture.
Mary Sayers from Children and Young People with Disability Australia.
Yes,
how are you going? Look, interesting you're focusing on health in the first instance, and I guess we've had a lot of discussion today about the medical model of disability, which I'm sure you're well aware of, and how will people with disability be informing this mainstream capacity building? Because the risk, if it's just led by the health sector, is we're repeating some of the mistakes of the past if it's not led by people with disability. So,
okay, thanks, Mary. Firstly, we will be contacting all of the state and territory governments. We've already started that process, and we have done some analysis of their state and territory disability plans to call out what they see as some of the issues and priorities in relation to access to good quality health systems for people with disabilities. We also note that that's missing in some state and territory disability plans, and so we're asking them directly, do they have some priorities? Are there other documents, such as the Vic Health document that was just presented, that we can turn our attention to? One of the things that I haven't mentioned is that ILC sits in this funny little space in that within the policy, we are not to duplicate the existing funding of other governments and other government services. So we have to be careful that we're not duplicating, if we're talking about employment readiness of people with disability, that we're not duplicating something that's already funded through DSS. If we're looking at health, that we're not duplicating something that's provided by a particular state or territory government. So as part of the assessment process, we have people with a disability advising us, but we also seek feedback from the state and territory governments to make sure that, A, it's targeted correctly and it's in line with state and territory priorities, but also that it's not a job that sits fairly and squarely within the province of the state and territory or local government. So we've got a few checks and balances in place. We've got some more work that we'd like to do in that space that'll evolve over the coming 2 to 3 years around collaborative commissioning, where we have a much more joined up approach about that, and I've got a slide on that in a minute. But I think it's important to recognise that many of these services should be universally accessible, and they aren't. And so the conversation that we've already had in relation to a number of grants is, well, yes, X or Y government or government department should be funding that, but they're not. So let's forget about what the ideal looks like. Let's actually go, we will provide this funding. We hope that we see an outcome, and we want to then bring those partners to the table to say, this has been proven to make a difference, which is why we want university partners on board to be able to undertake evaluations of these that would be robust and sufficient for a state government department to then go, yes, we will support this change in practice to ensure that it spreads beyond wherever the trial site was. So the final program is about economic and community participation, and it's really about building the capacity of the community to create opportunities for people with a disability to be able to contribute within their own community. And there'll be three streams occurring. So economic participation is around creating pathways to employment for people with disability, and specifically calling out volunteering as a pathway to employment for people with a disability. And I know that the scheme actuary has already been able to show through some of her analysis that the increases, or that people with disability who have entered into work as a result of the NDIS have typically engaged in volunteering activities first, which suggests something around potentially building a range of soft skills around, you know, being able to interact with others, building a sense of responsibility and ownership, potentially even just building the confidence to be able to catch public transport to get to another location to volunteer. But no one's looked in, drilled down to that level of detail, but you know, we can presume that there are a range of factors that have supported people who have previously volunteered to be able to gain employment. And we know that there have been studies looking at migrants that has also shown that effect. So social and community participation is around, we're looking at ideas and activities that will support people with disability to participate in community life. And we'll be looking at a small grants round, which is around activating community inclusion. So supporting changing attitudes, potentially providing small pieces of equipment to community groups and the like, you know, modified equipment that makes it easier for a person with a disability to participate. So whether that's running disability awareness training for members of the local AusKick committee, whether that's around having adapted easels for a local artist society, they're the sorts of things that we're considering now as part of this range.
Sorry, Daniel, thanks very much. I was just wondering, when you use the word streams, what that's going to look like and if that'll be different grant rounds or...
Yeah, so firstly, I'm not certain that you'll see the word streams in the grant rounds. There's someone developing a taxonomy about what all of the language is with their programs, activities, etc., etc. These will be, I guess, particular call-outs within the grant rounds. The grant rounds will go out either as economic and community participation or as mainstream, and then the, you know, kind of subheadings around what we're looking for that may or may not have different funding amounts put against each.
Fantastic, thanks.
Was there another question? A little bit more to go, but...
In 2005, I worked with Swinburne University, and we did a major evaluation of managed individual pathways for people with disability. Overwhelmingly, the participants in the study that I evaluated said that they didn't want jobs. They wanted to run their own businesses because it was actually better for people with disability not to have the stress of whether or not they'd lose their job or whether their health might vary more than average. And so they had more autonomy if they were running their own social enterprises. And we got quite a few of them through with support at Swinburne to running their own social enterprises. So, you know, I kind of look at what you've got up here, and it's really top-down kind of frameworks for community development. Like, the assumption is that the health service is serving people with disability well. The assumption is that the economic system is, as it's currently constructed, is going to serve people with disability well. Instead, like, if there was a stronger partnership orientation, you could actually develop systems that would be more inclusive rather than try to make systems that aren't necessarily giving good services as they currently are. accessible to people with disability. For a lot of reasons, people are ignoring them. They don't want to go to them. So, you know, for example, with economic participation, one of the real opportunities is looking at community economy and peer-with-peer economies and how consumers of services could establish their own economies to meet their own needs in localities or networks. And, you know, there doesn't seem to be that thinking anywhere implicit in the model.
So, firstly, in relation to micro-businesses and entrepreneurship, our most recent round, which was the economic participation and interim round, that was laying the groundwork and letting us test some of the attributes of this program, did actually call out and... Yes, a grant funding round. Okay, I'll come to that question. It did call out support for entrepreneurship for people with disabilities. That
by people with disabilities?
Some will be, some won't. The minister's yet to make an announcement. But absolutely the intent is that we look where possible for activities that are led by people with a disability. To the other points around the systemic models, I think ILC exists because we recognise that the current models don't necessarily work and we want to provide evidence-based approaches on how they might work. Having said that, I worked a number of years ago with the Business Council of Australia, which represents the 100 largest corporations in Australia, on employment for people with disability, and it was heartening for me thinking going in there that this was window dressing, but that they actively recognised that their workforce needed to represent the community in all of its diversity, and particularly those that had a greater focus on retail. So let's kind of put miners to the side, but if you're talking the Woolworths, the Coles, the Telstra, you know, Wesfarmers, they were very interested not only in employment of people with disability, but what they needed to do to make their businesses more accessible. They recognised, particularly with the 1 in 5 campaign that was being run around the same time by the Every Australian Counts campaign, that people with a disability comprised a large group of consumers that they were missing out on, and they were interested in how they might change that. And we can see that through, if we look at the Building Inclusive Communities projects here in Victoria, with the sensory screenings that began as a project in Greensboro by a local Metro Access worker that's now nationwide, that Village and Hoyts run, you know, sensory friendly screening times every month. Similarly, the use of the quiet times for shopping with the major supermarkets is now increasingly spreading across the country, that began as a simple idea in one store, in one supermarket. So we are seeing change occur. We have to show people on both sides that we can make this happen and that they can do so without significant disruption to their existing business models. And that's what we're hoping in some of these spaces, that we can do this work.
Few people watching on live stream.
Yes.
And they're sending questions to my phone. So I've got a question for you from the live stream.
Yes.
This is from Deaf Victoria. They said the mainstream capacity building round looks great. Deaf Victoria is currently doing 2 projects that relate to deaf people and health. Who can we talk to about more information?
For the mainstream round?
For the mainstream round.
Right.
When you were talking about the health intersection.
I'll say that we are going to be running a webinar. We're currently planning a webinar, so I hope that occurs either in the last week of July or the first week of August. And we will then be running a series of sessions such as this around the country that people can come to. So we do have an email address where people can sign up for news, and then we will let you know if we've got your contact details. I think it's just ilc@ndis.gov.au. Should be at the end of my presentation. If not, I'll make sure that I get it distributed to you. And that's the easiest way to sign up and register. Also, in relation to when our grant rounds open, all of our granting activity is conducted through the DSS Community Grants Hub. So if people haven't signed up to that mailing list, they should, because it lets you know when a grant round opens. So I spoke before around two other bits that we were looking at to support the disabled persons organisations and family organisations to be able to deliver and to grow their capabilities. And the first of these is the establishment of what we're currently calling a technical support hub. We're open to any other names that sound better than that. But the role of the technical support hub will be to assist disabled persons organisations in not only implementing their activities, but also support them with other tasks, such as assisting with recruitment of committee members, providing governance training to committee members, supporting staff to understand around IT and ranging, you know, information and training around, you know, developing websites. So there's a whole range of skills that we see that would benefit the DPO sector, and we will be looking to establish this. It will be tendered out next year, early next year, and we'll be looking to have it up and running by mid next year to be able to support organisations. So any organisation that is getting funding through ILC, that is a disabled persons organisation or family organisation, will be able to call them up for some support.
Sorry to keep asking questions. No. Will that be a not-for-profit organisation that is running that, or will you be looking at a more commercial agency?
I honestly can't say. I mean, I don't want to prejudice anything, but I can think of a dozen different organisations who would be capable of delivering that. If we think about something like, you know, VCOS and all of the causes around the country, I think they're a well-placed organisation to do that sort of work. Equally, yes, I'm sure there'll be some consultants who want to jump in and say they'll provide that. I don't believe that anyone would be able to provide the whole range of services that DPOs would be seeking, but as long as they've got partnerships, say with an RTO, or, you know, if we're going to do governance training, that they've got to deal with Leadership Victoria or, you know, AICD or the like, yep. That's the sort of thing that we could foresee.
But I guess I was more cautioning against the sort of the big KPMGs and you know, the consulting firms that have, say they have capability but perhaps don't understand the sector.
Sure.
So,
appreciate that.
I'm sure you're aware of that.
Another question?
Sure.
So I come from more, I guess, the customer, so I'm a self-advocate.
Yes.
For my daughter. I was also wondering, is that capacity building also looking at the LACs and the early intervention partners? Because I would say some of that capacity is severely lacking. So, you know, right. For example, like my planner left the organisation, but I was never informed, so I was literally ringing for 2 months, leaving messages on a person's phone who I didn't have an email address for, and I obviously was never being answered. I guess probably a number of examples like that. So sort of building capacity around that, I guess.
Sure.
Understanding sort of how self-management works.
So short answer is no. The longer answer is yes. And what I mean by that is that we don't directly feed into the partners in the community, the LACs and the early childhood intervention coordinators. However, we are doing work with their area to improve their training, to make them more aware around ILC, and we're doing work to better integrate their work, to work with people with a disability who don't have a funded plan. We're doing things like working on the database so that we'll be able to capture an information and so that we can have appear on their screen, you know, geolocated information around there are these 15 funded activities through ILC in the local community, and, you know, they can refer people on. So we are doing work around that, which should hopefully improve their understanding. But allied to that, there's a whole lot of activities that are just happening within that area of the agency. And the next part to support people with a disability is what we're terming promising practices. And promising practices, as I said, we wanted to have a national approach, and we wanted to be able to support people with a disability where a good project emerges and be able to share that right across the country. And so we are also building a monitoring and evaluation framework and all of the infrastructure that goes with that to be able to identify whether the activities we are funding are delivering great results and outcomes for people. And where through our evaluation framework, we can see that particular activities are having above average results, then we will be going out and having a group of evaluators, you know, I'm picturing potentially some universities, to go and look at what is happening in those activities, to sit in some sessions, to look at their materials, to work with people to be able to shape those up, so to evaluate them more rigorously. And then if they continue to show potential, then we look at how we shape up those materials and that we make them available to all DPOs across the country so that they can implement them. And then working with something like the Tech Hub, we would provide training and facilitation on how to deliver those materials so that the DPOs, no matter where they are located, feel confident to be able to deliver that material in a way that it delivers outcomes for people with a disability. There's a question.
It's a cultural question as much as anything, and it's just about, you know, the tendency just to defer to, for example, a university department to be the evaluator. So would you consider, in terms of a capacity building initiative, engaging people with disability in participatory action research so that they can become empowered as the observers and inquirers and also the deliverers of reports on the programs that they're participating in? And, you know, you could get a lot more bang for your buck if you invested in people with disability as researchers rather than the university sector, who will add 20% just for administration charges.
Thanks again for the question. Absolutely nothing is ruled out at this point. I would say that we need to have some rigour around what we do. And so there might be a panel rather than an individual entity. So as long as we can assure that we've got a consistency in how an evaluation occurs, whether it's occurring in Geelong or in Townsville or in Karratha, so that we're confident that the funds that we're spending will deliver the same results no matter who picks it up to use, then absolutely we've got no issue with that approach.
So one of the weaknesses of a federal approach is you will just get one-size-fits-all kind of strategies rather than reflect the incredible diversity on the ground in communities that you could generate if you invested in local researchers. So, you know, the drive to have a homogenous frame will mean you'll miss so much richness.
Thanks. Finally, I mentioned earlier collaborative commissioning, and I spoke as to some of the reasons why we would do it, and that is that every state has its own peculiarities around the service systems that have been established and the supports or absence of supports that exist, and it's impossible for any single group or team to be aware of all the intricacies of what's occurring on the ground. So, for example, the Victorian maternal and child health care sector is far more advanced in supporting young children with developmental delays than in other states. And so that is not an area where we would look if, for example, an application was to come in relation to that very early year's work, whereas we might consider the same application if it were to be delivered in another state where they don't have already that level of expertise. So what we're really keen to look at doing is how we can create and feed from the ground up information around priorities for all of these programs so that we can understand exactly what's happening. And it's not just an exercise like I described earlier where we're doing some desktop reviews and speaking with bureaucrats, but actually we are feeding up, and I would love to be able to see us feed up from every local government disability action plan so that we're not only looking at jurisdictional level but actually at a sub-regional level around what types of supports are most favoured and desired by people with disability in those areas. So with that, I'm happy to take any further questions.
Sorry, another question.
Sure.
I just had the capacity building you mentioned about self-management.
Yes.
So I do self-manage, but I found there was a real lack of information or support or anything really, to be honest. So I understand there's sort of 8 to 10% of people currently self-manage. Is there plans to sort of try and push that to a higher level, and I guess how are you kind of hoping to achieve that?
Yep. So firstly, I think it's far in excess of 8 to 10%. It was certainly about 7% last year. There's been a big increase. I don't exactly know what the percentage is. I'm not going to try and make up a number, but it's certainly grown quite a bit. There are some materials out there. In fact, I've had people come to me and say, don't you dare fund another resource on self-management, because there's already 42 of them out there. And we'd prefer to see the money going to support facilitation of groups where people actually understand what those tools and resources are. So I am surprised to hear your comment around that. But absolutely, I would think that it would be the desire of every person to be able to manage their own funds, and that's something we should be aspiring to.
Another question?
Is there plans to make sure that there's people with disability involved in the planning process and on the ground level of actually implementing these things that are funded?
Yes. So certainly, as I mentioned, individual capacity building, we are calling out that we want DPFOs to run those. A DPFO is an organisation that is run by and for people with a disability, and so we're very clear on that. In relation to economic and community participation and mainstream capacity building, our preference will be for organisations that are aligning themselves with and involving people with a disability. I don't believe we will be able to achieve it in the first year of the grant rounds, but in subsequent years I would like to actually have that built in as part of the evaluation, requesting who they are working with and seeing a line item for paying people for their time for that consultancy.
Hello, my name is Anya. I'm from Darabin City Council, and my question is very, very self-driven, motivated. You've mentioned the Building Inclusive Communities program before, which is known as Metro Access, and
yes,
we all know it's coming to an end.
Yes.
What role would you foresee for local government, local council, to play in this ILC space?
It's a very interesting question, and one that I asked of the MAV, the Municipal Association of Victoria, just a week or two ago. Local government is interesting, particularly in relation to supporting people with a disability. Local government has quite a broad range of legislated responsibilities, but it also provides a broad range of activities for which it has no legislative responsibility. So there's no legislative responsibility around providing youth activities, but I nearly every council would do it. I'd be astonished if there was a council that wasn't doing that. Likewise, you know, providing support for arts and cultural activities, not a legislative base, but most councils do it. It's interesting that within building inclusive communities and metro access workers, that when initially surveyed, when the councils were initially surveyed earlier this year about their willingness to maintain their contribution, the majority of councils said that without that little bit of funding from the state government, they would cease that activity. Quite frankly, I'm appalled that councils that are turning over in excess of $50, $80, $100 million can't find $75,000 to $100,000 to fund a worker and some activities in their local area. It is beyond me. But absolutely, ILC has at its heart, as was mentioned earlier, some place-based approaches, particularly around, you know, community engagement and the like. And we see that councils have a really important role around coordinating some of that activity. What we'd really like to do is to not be putting up grant rounds with our own list of priorities generated in some kind of ivory tower somewhere in this land of bureaucracy, but actually driven by local needs, so that we could simply say, there's a really great disability action plan in the city of Stonington. You know, you apply for anything that they're calling out and you'll get funded.
Thanks very much. I guess just to start with, Daniel, I wanted to say thank you so much for coming to speak with us. I don't want to speak for other people, but I'm sure it's safe to say we really appreciate the time to hear more about the ILC, and the information is very welcome. I guess I was just wondering, down to brass tacks a little bit, but whether there's any details around the timing of some of the grant rounds that are coming up and around forward planning and things like that.
I think that's a great question. Our timelines have slipped a little bit with the election that got in the way, with the appointment of a new minister. I'm hopeful that the minister will endorse some timelines and that we can talk about these in probably in detail very soon. Having said that, I would be encouraging people to look at the ILC strategy, to take a look at the recent interim rounds that were run late last year and early this year for the DPFO and economic participation as some guidelines around the types of things that we'll be doing or the way it will be structured. I guess the big difference to note is that we'll be moving to multi-year funding for community organisations. So that makes a difference. The Minister has expressed a preference that we get the money flowing as soon as possible. That unfortunately kind of bangs up against the sector's desire to have longer opening rounds. So when the rounds do open, they will only be open for 4 weeks, and I'm well aware that people would like 6 or 8 weeks. We've pulled back from that because at the other end that also means another 2 or 4 week delay in getting funding happening, and as was alluded to earlier, with transition that's already occurred, there are many organisations who need to ensure some stability and funding for their organisation. So they not only want to hear now, but they actually want to see the funding flow now.
Any further questions? Particularly for people on live stream, the phone number should be up on the screen now, so you can text in your questions.
Another one? So sorry, I thought of another one. To date, the grant rounds have come out consecutively, like one at a time.
Yep.
And so you may not know what the next ones exactly look like if you're an organisation choosing to apply or waiting to see if the next one would be more suitable. With the three programs that are still to open up this year, hopefully, will there be information at the same time or will it be sequential again?
Thank you. That's actually a really good reminder for me to talk about the fact that there will no longer be any jurisdictional rounds. So every round now is a national round. There may be calls from time to time, but consider that the exception, and it might occur in the aftermath of a national round where we identify we just got no applications that are supporting remote individuals, or we've got no applications working with called communities in Tasmania, or whatever the case may be. But otherwise, all of our rounds will be national rounds. One of the other issues that we're aware of, and that's making it's a problem of our own making, has been the lack of clear communication as we've been working up the programs. And I think it's really important that people think about what their organisations are best suited to, and more importantly, what the mission of that organisation is. So we've seen organisations apply for every grant round, potentially using the same application, when they don't fit. What we really want to do is help organisations not endure mission drift, but actually stick close to the heart of what their mission is about. And so we would ask organisations to think about, are you best placed to do individual capacity building, or are you focusing on community participation? It's not to say that you can't do both, but for many organisations in this sector, they'd be far better off, you know, really excelling at one thing. When we release the grant guidelines, we will be looking, if we don't release them all simultaneously, we'll be looking to provide detailed information to help organisations make that decision. And spoiler alert, there's a potential that we might actually release some of the rounds simultaneously. Yes, Mary. Sorry. No, I'm here to take questions. I'll stand here all afternoon.
The mainstream capacity building around health, when are you thinking about the latter, education, justice and the other streams? Are they going to be this year, or are they likely to be next year?
Next year. So the decision around health was made based on feedback from states and territories as the first cab off the rank to try and address. In subsequent rounds, we will focus in. And the decision has been made because, as I mentioned, you know, they will be grants in the order of, you know, $1 to $2 million per annum for a couple of years, and we'll be funding, you know, kind of 30 to 40, so maybe, you know, three or four in each state. And if we were to look at multiple issues, we just wouldn't get the coverage to then, you know, really focus people's attention and create a conversation, potentially within COAG, around, well, you know, the totality of these projects has delivered this. We see this as a really great opportunity for health ministers to come together and have a conversation around how they might respond as a group to these issues. If we were to fund, you know, projects from all interface areas, we just wouldn't be able to you know, draw together that focus and have that conversation.
And just, it kind of builds on Daryl's point a bit before, in terms of the intersectionality between health, education, you know, because if we're looking at health and the health system, it's like, but there's sort of health in all the interfaces around. Will you be looking at proposals that potentially look at health? Is it only sort of hospitals, primary health, or is it looking at health in a range of settings?
No, we're getting down into some of the details here, but that's certainly not the intention that we're just focusing on primary health. It's really around, from my perspective, the outcomes, the health outcomes of people with disability are poorer than for the average Australian, and we will look at whatever high quality proposals offer some potential solution or alternative approach that might improve or the outcomes for people.
Okay, I think we've got time for about one more question, if anyone wants to sneak one last question in. Looks like you've solved the problems of the world, Daniel. Well done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Daniel. We all really appreciate having that insight into what's going to happen next, especially because a lot of our advocacy organisations are just waiting for information. So this has been really, really helpful. So thank you for making the time to come and speak to us today. Okay, that brings us to the end of the advocacy sector conversation for today. Thank you all for coming. Thank you to Expression Australia for our live stream. And thank you to the Auslan interpreters and to Michael at the back in making sure you can all hear everything properly. Safe travels home. See you next time.